The hour of 8 o'clock having arrived, I'll call to order state and local government operations, reform, technology, and elections. Representative Mahoney, House File 927. Representative Mahoney, I understand that House File 927 has to go to finance, so I will move that House File 927 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Members, in your packet, you have a memo from Mr. Shepard. The memo lists by page and line those sections of the bill that brings House File 927 to itself. Representative Mahoney, if you would refer to those areas of the bill, that would be appreciated. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I will follow Mr. Shepard's memo right down. He made it very simple. Page 3, lines 1 through 3, talks about performed anywhere in the state. At one time, or however it was worded the first time this bill was done 3 years ago, it exempted if you had a septic system or a non-municipal sewage system, and that was never the case. That exempted your indoor plumbing from any code authorization in the state. This just brings the, if you have a home that's on a septic system, under the plumbing code of the state. Page 4, lines 1 through 15, deals with, brings water conditioners underneath the state plumbing board. That's what they've asked for. They want to be, they want to have a place where they can get their rules done the same fashion the plumbing industry does. It eliminates the word plumbing contractors because there is no such thing. There are master plumbers and they are the only ones who can pull permits. Then it, and that is master plumbers, or plumbing contractors is on line 4.2. The water conditioners is on 4.4. Then on 4.11, adopt rules that regulate continuing education. This allows the plumbing board to put 8 hours of continuing education as a requirement for the license for a plumber in the state of Minnesota. Page 6, lines 14 through 29, references rules adopted by the plumbing board requiring licensure and certification for installation of medical gas systems. What we have found out is that although it's rather important in a hospital that you know what kind of gases are flowing in, no one was required to inspect it, or it because it was not underneath the fire code. So the fire department wouldn't inspect it, and it wasn't under the plumbing code, so the plumbing inspectors weren't claiming it. This just puts it underneath the plumbing code and requires the plumbing inspectors to take a look at it. Page 7, lines 10 through 11. Again, this goes to the water conditioning, and it's performed anywhere in the state, and it puts it underneath the plumbing board, and if there's an inspection to be done, it would be done by the plumbing inspector. Line page 7. Page 9, lines 2 and 20, transfer rulemaking authority related to water distribution centers from the commission to the plumbing board, and Mr. Shepard said it absolutely correct. It just transfers the rulemaking authority to the plumbing board, and the commissioner and the industry is more than okay with that. Section 20 on page 13 is a time limit because of a legal ruling by the Supreme Court. We found that municipalities did not have the right to say that if you started a project, siting project, you did not ever have the right to, I'm looking at the wrong one, section 20. Rules to the boiler engineer's continuing I'm going to drop down to section 21 on page 13. Directs the plumbing board to amend its rules to comply with statutory changes made in this bill and allows it to use good cause rulemaking exemptions. If the we are incorporating specific rules set forth in statutes. There should not be a extensive rulemaking process which saves the state money. And the department has said it will save approximately $200,000. I'm not following on 20 because the boiler engineer continuing education and education equivalences is not something I looked at. So let me give you just a moment, Mr. Chair. That doesn't seem right. Provides 18 months additional rulemaking. Oh, okay. It just provides, according to the department and Mr. Shepherd, it just provides 18 more months of additional rulemaking authority for boiler engineers to continuing education as they figure out what they want them to do.
Representative Mahoney, by my count, this is the eighth committee this bill has been through.
I stopped counting after the fourth one, Mr. Chair.
All right. So it probably has been vetted as well as anything we've heard. Is there anyone who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Any discussion to the bill? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, on page 3, lines 1 through 3, that change there, would that in effect give the plumbing board the ability to write rules pertaining to outhouses at White Cabin?
Representative Mahoney.
No.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, can you explain to me where that exemption exists in this language when we say that an outhouse, I suppose, could be considered plumbing installation performed anywhere in the state? So where is the exemption that wouldn't allow them to have that?
Representative Mahoney. I believe an outhouse would be covered under a DNR or PCA. An outhouse is just a hole in the ground with a shed over it. It doesn't have much to do with plumbing. Or plumbing regulations, not connected to a potable water system or a municipal sewer system or even a private sewer system.
Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, the motion is to
finance?
Pass House Bill 927 and re-refer it to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you,
Mr. Chair, committee members.
The next bill is House Bill 723, Representative Murphy. It is the Omnibus Retirement Bill. That's a rather, I think it's about 200 pages. And we do have two individuals who wish to testify on the bill, but Representative Murphy, if you would walk us through the bill, not line by line necessarily, but
page by page, Mr. King.
Representative Murphy, it's up to you. We did start a half hour earlier anticipating this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have a brief summary that I can go through, and then if there are questions or articles that you want us to go back to,
Representative Murphy, I will move that House File 723 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. So the bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 723 is the Omnibus Pension Bill, as you know, and it has 13 articles. Article 1 is a technical article which removes references to the post fund as a result of the bill that passed last year. And the post fund was the fund that separated the active employees from the retired employees in three of the major plans. And we put the post-retirees, the people that were already retired, in with the active people if the funds got down to 80%. And never when I appeared last spring talking about that bill did I dream that that would happen so quickly. I expected 2 or 3 years out, but then the world market changed, and the stock markets changed, and the stock markets changed, and the stock markets changed, and now the funds are at a point where they have to merge the retirees in with the active. And this takes the references from the post fund out of the legislation. And the most significant section of this article is Section 70, which defines the smoothing technique that will be used to blend the post fund with the active fund for purposes of determining actuarial value of assets. Article 2 modifies the description of disability benefits for MSRS, the state plan, which will result in an actuarial cost savings in the future. And this tightens the definition of line of duty disability benefit for the correctional retirement plan and the state retirement, state patrol retirement plan, and it puts them on a very similar basis as PERA already was. Is. Article 3 is the state correctional plan membership change that takes place once a year, and they are recommending one person to come into the correctional plan, and that is the automotive mechanic, and it went through the orderly process that was established 3 years ago for admitting new people. Article 4 is the technical and administrative modifications, which deals with some technical and housekeeping cleanup language requested by the three statewide retirement systems and the first class city teachers plans. But it also corrects or addresses the problem that occurred in Duluth, Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, the Duluth Airport Authority, and the City of Virginia, where they misrepresented what was a they included a benefit as part of the salary that the pension was based on, and that was found, and that was has to be corrected. And sections 11, 12, 49, and 50 represent those corrections. Article 5 is the phased retirement program for local government. It was requested for budgeting and workforce planning for cities and counties to be able to keep more people on staff, and it's actuarially cost neutral, and it just adds a post-retirement employment program to PERA, similar to that which has been in place for state agencies and their employees for the past several years. The PERA program is made available only to people over age 62 and is at the discretion of the employer, and allows a person to start collecting his or her pension without resigning from the job, but the person must reduce the number of hours worked to half-time or less. So we're not creating a situation where they're on full-time retirement and still working. But it does allow some of the more senior people then to ease out and train the new people coming in. Article 6, perhaps the most talked about article, is the teacher retirement benefit and funding changes, which contains teacher retirement association changes for improving long-run funding stability and sufficiency of the fund. It also contains teacher benefit equalization reforms to address benefit inequities for teachers hired after 1989, because they do not have the same benefits that the people that they're working side by side with that were hired before 89. The two goals, the two main goals of this Article 6 is to, as I said, retain financial stability and to reform pensions and attract and retain teachers, strengthen the education system, and remedy benefit inequities. We will, if this is enacted, we will increase employee and employer contributions by 0.5% of pay per year, deferred until July 1, 2011, and it'll be phased in over 4 years. The increased cost to school districts would be offset by increases in school aid.
Representative Murphy, I'm going to interrupt you just for a second. I understand that what we're actually working off of is the DE4 amendment. It's a rather large delete everything amendment. I'm going to move the DE4 amendment so that everyone understands that's what we're working from, and then we'll act on the amendment once you're done describing it. Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Article 7, our Minsky proposal provisions, and it authorized the Minsky Board to establish early separation incentive program consisting of cash incentives, employer contribution to the state retirement system, post-retirement health savings plan, or a combination of the two. The cost of the incentives would be borne by Minsky. The program would be sunset after 5 years. Section 3 permits faculty members to elect TRA coverage within 1 year of achieving tenure and requires those faculty members making the TRA election to purchase service credits for the pre-tenure services at the full actuarial value purchase price. This is not a buyback situation. This is for future hires. Minsky, they could do this at an institution, but not at all institutions. They could, for the sections 1 and 2, they could have this early separation, or they could devise something for a particular school. They would have to pay for the whole thing themselves, and it would only affect that school or that particular college or university. Article 8 is a change in the St. Paul teachers' post-retirement increases. Their pilot project ended. They had a 2-year pilot program which allowed them to calculate their actuarial costs at a different in a different way. It is now a consumer price index and it's capped at 5%. And the pilot program will expire, and we are allowing them to start another pilot program that will last 2 years because they're on a roll. Article 9, local police and paid fire relief association changes, extends the full funding date to, for the Fairmont Police. Representative Gunther came and asked us to extend the full funding date until December 31st, 2020, and we're allowing that, and we're also allowing the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association to reduce the size of its board of trustees. Article 10 is a voluntary statewide lump sum volunteer fire retirement plan that was developed by a working group, a voluntary program. It's voluntary. People do not have to do this. The relief association does not have to do this if they do not want to. But if they want to, the opportunity is there for them to have a new plan and to be in a statewide plan where they could get better returns on their investment, possibly. It's supported by the Fire Chiefs Association, by the Fire Department Association, by the Minnesota Area Relief Association Coalition, by the League of Cities, by the Township Associations. And at the end of the group that worked this out, no one was in opposition that came to speak. Article 11 is the Volunteer Fire Relief Association. Changes that were worked out with the state auditor and working group, and the recodification separates Chapter 424A into separate sections for defined contribution plans and defined benefit plans. And the state auditor convened the working group, and it met for 4 years and is recognized as an important forum for discussing relief association issues. And they worked out these recommendations. Article 12 is a technical correction to take care of a drafting error from 2008. It corrects another error that was made in the post fund, and it affects the MRF fund. It's a technical correction only. Article 13 is an individual constituent plan provisions. There's no cost to any of the plans in this one. Section 1 to 3 deals with Department of Transportation pilots and eliminates that plan from the future, for future hires. And sections 4 through 9 allows Minneapolis Police Relief Association and Minneapolis Fire Relief Association to be added to PERA statutes in the definition of governmental subdivisions for the purpose of the relief association's administrative staff to be participants of PERA coordinated plan. Section 10 was an ordinance bill which allowed an employee of the City of Elizabeth liquor store who was not reported to PERA when she became eligible to be granted a few months of credited service after that was caught. Section 11 also allows the PERA member from Elizabeth, from both PERA and PRA, to rescind her retirement application with both retirement plans and continue paying into PERA. Section 12 was Representative Lilly's bill, which allowed a PERA member who was a former MSRS member to have her 6 months of recent school district employee backed out of her account because the additional service earned in PERA would reduce her pension. And we didn't think that was fair, and Representative Lilly didn't think that was fair. Section 13 was the Representative Gill bill, which allowed an exemption for a MSRS general plan person from Silver Bay to apply for disability benefits. And we're changing the 180-day deadline in current law for that. Section 14 was the bill that allowed certain state employees that had participated in a job share plan to get the same benefits that the people that had earlier gotten them. Section 15, Representative Loon, allows the PERA coordinated plan member to apply for disability benefits even though she does not meet the minimum requirements to do so.
Discussion to the amendment. Then I'll renew my motion on the DE4 amendment. This will put the bill in order. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted to the bill as amended, members. Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, I understand this is not a finance committee, I realize, but I understand this is going to cost taxpayers more money at a time when they're experiencing loss of their own retirement savings. And it also does not include a governor's provision, as I understand. that would have saved about $6 million a year. Can you speak to those issues?
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, the only big cost thing is in the future for the PRA benefit plan, and that would be additional state aids that we would have to consider appropriating state aids for that in the PRA package, and that's about 5% or 3% or 1.3% depending on which plan we select. There is a deficit, and if the longer we wait to address the deficit in PRA, the more it's going to cost. So the quicker that we address the deficit, the better off we will be, and the less the taxpayers will have when they are already in a situation where things are not financially good. But they are going to have to address, the quicker we address it, the less it will cost. The second provision that was discussed by the governor, proposed by the governor, was a change in the correctional plan and to reduce the numbers of people in the correctional plan. We addressed that in when we went over the governor's recommendations at the pension commission, and meeting. One was for informational, and then there was a second meeting, and I chaired that meeting. That was at the end of my term. And I chaired that meeting, and we had a very lengthy discussion on what the governor was proposing. But it seems like the cost savings that you referenced in that proposal was in the collective bargaining health care issue rather than the pension issue. And Senator Bechtel had a later hearing in which we discussed the issue of the governor's recommendations in its entirety one more time. And again, it became clear to the pension commission that the cost savings was a collective bargaining issue, not a pension issue. And it was for the 10 years of or up to 10 years of health care that an employee received. And it was in the discussion of the pension commission, it was that should be addressed for the cost savings, not the pension requirements. And so there was a motion to include the governor's proposal on this pension bill, and it did not receive any votes.
Further discussion. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, Article 8, as I read the summary here, it looks like we're allowing the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund to increase post-retirement benefits. Representative Murphy, can you tell me what the liability increase will be for the St. Paul School District in doing in increasing that?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Wright or Mr. Kasper?
All right, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Brian Reif, and the attorney for the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. Mr. Kaplan's not here, but to represent a Biscoe's question, there is a modest increase in the estimated unfunded accrued liability. Our actuaries have estimated that over time this provision, and this would be over a long period of time, I think the actuary took 100 years of consumer price data, that we could expect the actuarial cost, the increase to be 2.7%, as opposed to the current estimates, which I believe is based on 2.5%. There's a caveat with that, however. That's arithmetic average over a 100-year period. It would depend at the starting date. If, for example, inflation was very low in the early years of that period, you might not actually realize a 2.7% increase. A dollar amount number, the total funds liabilities are about $1.4 billion, so roughly 0.2% of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Rice. Rather than talk percentages, let's talk real numbers. Can you tell this committee what the St. Paul School District's current unfunded liabilities are for their other post-employment benefits?
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that I could. That would be a school district number, not a pension number. Are you talking, Mr. Chairman, Representative Vickens, you're talking about health care costs that would be an item of collective bargaining?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I am, Mr. Rice. So this has nothing to do. This provision is only with the pension component and not with other post-employment benefits.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tom, did you want to add to this or need to?
Yes, I think I do. We've had, what this is, just to hope I can end debate on this, this is continuing a two-year pilot program, and the two-year pilot program saved $49 million by divorcing the COLAs from investment returns. And this proposed new two-year pilot program, remembering we're just continuing a pilot program, it again bakes the COLA on the CPI the same as Social Security. And all of the major funds, we've decided this is right for all the major funds, they get a fixed 2.5% guaranteed post-retirement benefit, and the St. Paul teachers will float between 0 and 5%. So we think this is actually a fiscally prudent way to take care of their problems.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Rice, what would happen if we don't pass this? It's my understanding they go back to what they were prior to the last two-year plan, where there's an uncapped return on, or an uncapped increase they could have if there was good financial returns. Is that
right.
Correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, yes, that would be correct. There would be a 5% cap that would kick in I believe a year or two under I think in 2010. But for the current year, the rates theoretically could be uncapped. But this is an effort to change from one system to a new system. I think the commission wanted to continue a two-year pilot to evaluate it, and we fully expect to be back in this committee within 2 years, Mr. Chairman, with either a permanent solution or another two-year pilot.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Rice, this is basically, we're saving money here, because if they got good investment returns, they could have much higher than the 2.7 increase or the 5% increase under what their old provisions were. Is that correct?
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, you're correct.
I have Roger Aronson that wishes to testify on the bill. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Roger Aronson. Mr. Chair, members, I represent the Elementary and the Secondary Principals Association, and I don't know that I can add anything in terms of Article 6. We have 1,700 members. We appreciate Representative Murphy's work on this, and others, and Representative Thiessen as well, and others, and we strongly support the bill, and I think that just would endorse Representative Murphy's comments as she described that provision and as it relates to schools and our clients and their effective operation. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Questions to the testifier? All right. Thank you, Mr. Arrington. Further discussion to the bill. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Would Representative Murphy again explain how school districts would gain access to the funds they need to fund the higher contributions to TRA?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, there would be increased employee and increased employer contribution.
Representative Anderson.
I thought you also mentioned some increased state aid.
And
Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair, to increase the employer contributions, there has to be more state aid.
Representative Anderson.
So would that require further legislation besides this bill?
Representative Murphy.
Section 1, Article 6, but mainly I think what it does is require further discussion of the funding for the school aid formula for education, or how many education dollars are necessary to fund education.
Representative Murphy, do you want to have someone else respond to that question in detail?
If there are people here that...
Well, I don't know how many necessarily, but...
Mr. Thompson?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. I believe Representative Anderson had asked a question dealing with how this is going to be funded by the employer and by the employee, and whether or not there would have to be state aid that would have to be added to the formula in order to fund the bill. I think that was Mr. Representative Anderson's question. So please identify yourself for the record.
Luther Thompson, representing TRA. Yes, it would require additional state aid. But recognizing the current budget concerns and the current economic realities, it is not scheduled to be implemented until the next biennium starting in FY 2012, and then it would only be phased in a quarter or a half a percent per year.
Representative Biskin.
Thank to
that point, is
there any language in this bill which would give the school district discretionary remedy, i.e., property tax, if the
state aid were not forthcoming?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative
Biskin. No, there is not. All right. Further discussion to the bill is amended. Anyone else wish to testify? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 723 is amended, be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee.
Representative Hosh, House File 866. If the audience that needs to leave would leave quietly, it would be appreciated. We have a long agenda. You can discuss the pension bill outside, not here. You had that opportunity. Representative Hosh, I'm going to move that House File 866 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. And with that, members, you have Mr. Shepard's memo in your packet. You have two sections of the bill that bring it to us. I would hope our discussion would be focused on those two sections. and that's why the bill is here. So, Representative Hosh, to those sections.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate the time, especially with the last day of deadline here. I will focus on the majority of my comments on Section 7, Subdivision 14. Overall, this is the statewide health insurance pool for school employees, but mainly under this committee's jurisdiction, I understand, is within the makeup of the committee that would have plan design decisions for the employee pooling group for health insurance. The committee that would be in charge of plan designs and other demonstration or pilot programs would consist of 14 members. Seven of those members would be school employees, appointed by Education Minnesota, four of them, one by Service Employees International Union, one by AFSCME, and one by the School Employees Association. The other seven members with equal representation would be appointed by the Minnesota School Boards Association. This group would operate mainly under the Taft-Hartley model. Compensation for the committee would be described as in under Section 15 of our state statutes, which allow for compensation up to $55 per day plus expenses. If an individual employee is compensated with their employer, they would not then be compensated under Statute 15.0575. Child care expenses would also be reimbursed if they were incurred, and also if a school employee would not be compensated through their employer, they would then be compensated through the committee at the full amount. With that said, I think that's about it, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Before we do that, I have three people who wish to testify, and first is Scott Kronquist. And again, I'd like to focus testimony to those sections of the bill that bring it to us. So, Scott Kronquist is here. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. We represent 35 school districts in the Seven County metropolitan area. AMSD does remain opposed to House File 866, Mr. Chairman and members, for a variety of reasons, but again, I'll try to confine the comments to the provisions before you. Section 5 would require the commissioner to develop a new segment of the public employees insurance program by which all school employees would be mandated to be pooled in. There are currently 4,000 covered lives in that pool. This would expand that to over 200,000 lives. Despite no evidence that a pool of such size is going to do anything to create efficiencies or to bring costs down. Moving on to Section 7, that pool, then, Mr. Chairman and members, will be governed by a 14-member board. And there is no language in this section that would require any kind of expertise or knowledge or experience in dealing with health care. We think that at a minimum there should be some maybe training requirements required or some kind of criteria set in place that would require some level of knowledge and expertise in this area. Well, I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you.
Questions to the testifier? All right. Seeing none, the next person is Grace Kelleher. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every school district in the state of Minnesota, and we are opposed to this bill. I really want to focus, Mr. Chairman, on Section 5, and our concern is a little bit different from AMSD's. If you look sort of in the middle of that line, it says the initial offering shall be PEEP Advantage, PEEP Value, and Advantage HSA plans, which is the initial offering districts would have to go to. We have about 300 plans now, and this requires a transitioning to these three plans that we've never done on a level we've never done from, and it's not clear how we go from where we presently are in providing health care to these three plans and then on to whatever plans the committee might develop. So there's actually two changes required in here without clarity on how school districts get there. Concerns that come to our mind are we cannot uniformly lower employee health benefits on our own. State statute forbids that. So if we're all rounding up the top plan offered in this model may be less than quite a few of our school employees receive, and there's no clarity on how to do this or actually make this work as we go forward. We're also concerned about retirees. When you retire from a school district, you are guaranteed the health program and the provider you retired under. So all the present programs that we have retirees retiring under still have to be maintained until those employees have moved through the system. And some of them are a benefit till death. So we really need some work on how this would really look as it rolled out, Mr. Chairman. We have big concerns that this could cause real problems, headaches, and costs for school districts.
All right, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelleher, this bill is not new. It's old. This provision has been around for a long time. I understand that you're opposed to the bill on principle. The question is, do you have any suggestions or ideas for how we would amend the Section 5 or other relevant sections to make it more workable in the event the bill went forward?
Ms. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, this bill has been around for a long time, but there's some real differences in this bill that we haven't seen in past years. This initial offering is a different piece we've never seen, where there were three plans actually stated in text. Also, it was not clear how we ever deal with retirees, and we'd really like to see language on that, and that we certainly would be willing to work going forward to come up with language to address some of these, but there's never been an interest or we've never been approached as a partner in this.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Kelleher, I think that the bill has been on its way for so long. This particular provision, it's not that it's new. I mean, it's House File 866. It wasn't just introduced this week. And I would say that from my observation, there has been a lack of willingness from Education Minnesota and school districts to partner and negotiate and try to work something out that actually might work for both sides. And so I guess I have a little bit of concern with if you come in and oppose this section and point out all the things that you see is wrong with it but don't have any ideas for how it might be made better. And I'll make the same similar tone of comments to Education Minnesota, because I don't think that we should be in a situation year after year where we're fighting over something that shouldn't have to be so hard. So I'd like to hear some positive suggestions about how it could be improved from your perspective rather than just opposition on those sections.
Ms. Kelleher, you wish to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, our association did adopt under the last and in Redden's report. They had a list of things that Education Minnesota and MSBA agreed on, having a statewide pharmaceutical benefit, having a reinsurance piece. And unfortunately, they've never been reflected in the bill you see in front of you. And we've talked to members about it and tried to move them forward, and they've always been reluctant to go up against this kind of bill because it comes from a taking sort of. So we did come to agreement over areas we really thought were important. I'd always hope they'd be reflected at some point in this bill.
President Gumbel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, let's be clear. This bill has been around a while. These concerns have been raised before, along with many others that are outside the jurisdiction of this committee. I think it's rather reprehensible for us to criticize somebody who decides to testify against any part of this bill. It's their right to do so. I'm disappointed this proposal has not moved further myself. I had a question regarding whether or not teachers can currently voluntarily enter PEIP. I believe they can. But, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I'm going to move to table this bill and ask for a roll call.
Motion has been made to table. Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Anderson?
Pass.
Gibson?
Yes.
Emmer?
Yes.
Butler?
Yes.
Guilty?
No.
Hornstein? Hahn?
No.
Taylor?
No.
Kismeyer?
Yes.
Lanning?
Yes.
Markport?
No.
Morrow?
No.
Nelson?
No.
Austin?
Yes.
Sanders?
Yes.
Simon?
No.
Thank you.
There being 6 ayes, 9 nays, and 2 abstentions, the motion does not prevail. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just if the time is appropriate to respond.
I've got one more testifier, okay. And I think we'll let, because these individuals are signed up in advance and we're running on a tight schedule. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm a lobbyist representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the 8 nonprofit health plans that provide health care to Minnesotans. Mr. Chairman, I'll repeat the comments that have been made briefly regarding Sections 5 and Section 7. We oppose House File 866. We believe that the adoption of this type of insurance mechanism should be done through the insurance statutes in this state, and Section 5 would be far improved if we actually did that in the way that we do it with creating all other insurance companies rather than creating this new type of board. Mr. Chairman, members, the provisions of Section 7, as Ms. Kelleher and Mr. Krenquist stated, creates a new board without the expertise to run what is going to be one of the largest health plans in the state. And we would highly recommend that if you want to do that, you should actually bring in some expertise to do that. Mr. Chairman, if I could, to Representative Winkler's provisions, I've got 12 pages of testimony and suggestions that we've made that I would be happy to read to the committee that don't pertain to these sections about how we could improve this bill. But I know that's not under the jurisdiction of this committee. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if there are questions, we'd be happy to address them. But again, I'd like to reiterate our opposition to the passage of health violations.
All right. I had two representatives that were on the list prior to the motion to table. So Representative Tan, to the testifier, or?
Oh, not really. It's really to the bill.
All right. Representative Biskins, to the testifier. To the bill. All right.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Any questions to this testifier? No. All right, then Representative Hosh, do you want to respond to anything that's been said recently?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few things. One, we've heard two things. One, that this is an old bill, and two, that there's new provisions in here that specify the plans in here. I think those are kind of contradictory. This may be an old idea, but this is a new approach and a new bill. First is we did hear concerns that there wasn't a flexibility in plans in the past. This has three different service plans that can be offered, the Advantage Value, and the HSA plan. Comments were made that there's over 300 plans already, and now we're only moving into three plans. That's 300 plans among all of our school districts, so I think that's a little different, and to put that into legislation isn't feasible. It was also mentioned that all employees are mandated under this legislation. It is not. Self-insured or self-insured pools or groups can be exempted from this, and that is in another section that's not in front of the committee's jurisdiction, but I want to clarify that. And then lastly, one of the suggestions that we heard in the past was, you know, why not join PEEP? Why not do this statewide health insurance bill through PEEP? And that's exactly what we did here. There's been an effort to try to find some compromise to take into consideration some of the concerns. You have my word as author of this bill. I will continue to try to do that. It is my goal to have a bill move forward in the process that takes into those concerns and has a bill that can be signed by the governor.
Right. Now, members, I do have, I'm going to go back to the Representative Khan to the bill now.
Yes.
Representative Khan.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess one of the reasons I voted against this bill in the past has been the absence of any ability of districts that clearly don't need to be in it to opt out. And so we're actually made a step in that direction with the language that allows self-insured districts to drop out. But I still have and you know, Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite sure. This whole bill seems to be a gov operations bill because it's setting up an entire unit, and so it's hard to just concentrate on the things that put groups in place. But I'd like to know why one wouldn't allow school districts, for example, that have formed into cooperatives that might have almost a similar size as the self-insured units to also, you know, cooperating school districts also to opt out above a certain size. I understand that you need a minimum size for this to work, although that seems to be less necessary since you're putting them into an existing pool of teeth, but why wouldn't one broaden it to allow districts that are formed into a cooperative that's above a certain size to also opt out?
Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Town, if you look at line 2.29 and 2.32, not only are districts that are individually self-insured, but also part of a self-insured group, which would be that cooperative that you referenced.
Okay.
Representative Town.
The Chairman. Does that mean that they have to be existing as a self-insured group, or could they form into a self-insured group?
Representative Hunt.
I can't quite figure it out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, the way that I read it is an existing self-insured group at this point. The language, though, I think does need some improvement, especially for term of opt-out, or if you do opt-in, you know, how long must you stay in until you can opt-out again. And those are things that I can work on to clarify.
Okay, I'm not...
Representative
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that it should pass out of this committee without it being clarified. But I do know we're nearing the end of our deliberation. But when you look at Section 15, the effective date, does that mean that any cooperative unit, if a cooperative unit formed and became self-insured, they could then opt out?
Representative Haas.
Before that, if as long as they did it in the next 2 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Khan, as the language, as I read it, yes. If they were to form before January 1st of 2011, they could opt out.
Okay. Then.
Representative Khan?
Yes. And then the final thing, which is, again, I think this is within the jurisdiction of the committee because CGIP, we use the term of CGIP, which is the state information. I have heard from someone who heard the bill previously that these plans that are all being offered are very high deductible plans. Is that true or not true? And I wasn't aware that CGIP had really high deductible plans. And I guess, Mr. Chairman, you know, I don't know if you have the answer at hand right now, but I would actually like to see the provisions in CGIP compared to the provisions of the three plans that are being offered in that. And I don't, obviously, unless you have it at hand now, I don't need it at hand now.
Someone who can answer the question. Welcome to committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Lee Johansson. I'm with Education Minnesota. Mr. Chair, Representative Khan. The three plans that are offered, starting with the Advantage plan is an exact clone of what is presently offered to the state employees, so that is the CGIP offer. The other two plans then progressively have larger deductibles, and this is necessary that this be created because current plans reflect that broad spectrum, and if you just moved everybody into the CGIP model, there would be additional costs that would be experienced that would be an unfunded mandate.
Representative
Khan. Mr. Chairman, who decides which of the three plans the district goes into? The district itself, the individual members of the district, or what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Khan, that would be a matter of local negotiations, but we don't see any reason why they would restrict the option of the individual to make that choice.
Okay.
Representative Biskin.
Except I would like that. I would like to be sure that plan is a clone of the CGIP, so I would like to see those provisions out. Obviously, not right now.
Representative Hush.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, that is a good question. Under the statutes referenced, they are not exempt from this legislation at this time.
Representative Biskins.
Mr. Chair, there's over 150 charter schools, and then you look at who forms this organization that will govern their employee health insurance, they don't have a seat at the table. And that's very disconcerting, especially for one of the largest sectors of public school growth. The other thing I have, one other issue, and that's if it looks like this is one for China. So when I was a rookie legislator, a senior legislator by the name of Representative Kevin Knight, you guys have been working on a twin stadium issue for eons. When will this issue go away? We can know it every year. When will it go away? And he looked me in the eye and he said, it will go away when the state publicly funds a twin stadium. He was right. This issue we have dealt with over and over again. There are some people who philosophically believe that we don't need to create one big pool. That the issues we have in health insurance isn't about pooling and a whole lot of other issues that play here. There are some who philosophically believe this is wrong and will always vote no, just like there are some who will always vote no for public financing of safety.
Roll call has been requested. There'll be a roll call on the bill when we get to that motion. Representative Hosh, do you want to respond to that? You don't. Representative Winkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions for Mr. Johansson. First of all, I understand that this bill is one of your organization's top legislative priorities, and I wonder if the leader of your organization is here to testify in favor of it.
Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, no, he's not here today.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, to Section 7 in this Health Insurance Committee, this raises a question that I had, and that is whether the staff of Education in Minnesota would be required to be participants in this pool as well.
Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, no, they are not. In an earlier version of the bill, they were included, but due to objections from members of the committee, they were excluded.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johansson, we've heard from Ms. Kelleher and Mr. Griffin that they have offered, well, first of all, Ms. Kelleher said that there was a committee that got together and they had points of agreement and consensus on things that could be done. And I wonder why that bill isn't here instead of this one.
Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler. As a matter of fact, the Redmond Anders Study Commission, I was the co-chair of. And I would say that the 14 members of the committee, made up in the same fashion that we're proposing for the governing of the insurance bill, reached consensus on the entire report. What we did not reach consensus on was the therefore, which was the proposed legislation. But in fact, the entire report that said that the statewide plan was feasible, that said that there would be stability, that said there would be a savings, was agreed to by all 14 members of the committee. And so in fact, we believe that it is represented in this bill. This is the starting point. Now, over the years, it's accommodated the wishes of legislators, and we've worked with people to improve it. But if you look at the original bill that's included as the recommendation of the majority in the Redmond Anders report, you will recognize many of the features that are still in this bill.
That's the one question.
Mr. Chair, and then to Mr. Griffin's point that he had pages of recommendations for how to specifically change it and improve the bill. Have you accommodated any of those suggestions or requests for changes to make this something that is a little less adversarial?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, yes, we've worked with anybody who has worked with us. We've made arrangements for dealing with M10 premium taxes after consultation with the parties. We had proposals that, in fact, if we only would create a clone of CGIP, that would solve the problems. And so we've done that. We've reached out time and time again and made modifications in an attempt to address those concerns that have been raised.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johansson, it's awfully hard for us to, I think, reconcile one group of people saying that they haven't been accommodated, that they have things that they want to see different, and that that you haven't reached out to them as partners with your statements that you have tried to do just that. And in fact, that points to the larger problem with this bill, which is that it's very hard to understand what exactly has happened in negotiations and discussions, really who can support what and where there is possible compromise, because both sides seem to be so dug in on their respective points. But I have one final question about this, the PEEP offering, which is that I understand that all the districts that have considered these offerings from PEEP have rejected them. Is that true?
Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I believe about half of the locals that are currently insured in PEEP are school districts. So we do have school districts that are currently insured. Now, it is true last spring we had a fairly large number of locals, our locals, who sought bids, and due to the lateness of submission of data and everything, time just simply ran out before the necessary work could be done to perhaps bring about a change. So it is accurate to say that last spring, none of those who sought a bid made the change. I might point out that there's about 90 schools that are currently in the process of doing that, and hopefully time won't run out this year and they will be able to make a decision for the short term. But I think it's a mischaracterization to imply that no school has done this, because in fact they have.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I could put the question differently. Did 55 locals reject this last year or the last couple of years?
Mr. Johans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I think rejection isn't the right word. There may have been 55, and that's not a number that I necessarily know, but I don't disagree with it. There may have been 55 that sought bids, but in fact, in a number of the cases, by the time the bidding information arrived, the timeline had run out, and in fact, the end of the school year came, and they weren't really acted on. So I suppose you can say because they didn't make the move, I suppose you could call that as rejection, but I don't think that there was a conscious rejection in many cases, just that the timeline ran out.
Final comment then. It seems to me that we're forcing districts into a program that a lot of them have real problems with this bill. And I think, in fact, in general, the bill requires a great deal more work. So this is to you also, Representative Hosh, before it should ever be moved out of the Finance Committee or onto the floor. I'm going to support the bill today because I understand the problems with health insurance. I understand that the teachers with very high rates, and by the way, the bill doesn't require districts to offer health coverage, so it doesn't really do anything for districts that aren't offering it now, which is another significant change I think that you need to see here. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And my sense is that there isn't a lot of compromise being offered on either side to address this issue. I've really not heard a big proposal from the school districts on how to address these issues either. And I think that before it gets to the floor, before there's a vote on the floor, there should be some serious changes in this bill if you want to try to do anything other than force it through the legislature.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I concur with Representative Winkler's comments there, but I wanted to ask about Representative Haas, and I know this isn't related to something we're supposed to talk about, but it's the 2.29 to 2.32, the self-insured. And I understood that was offered by another member as an amendment. And I just wanted to know from you as the author what your intention is regarding that particular provision in this bill, if you're intending to keep it in the bill, and what your position is.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy. With that amendment, by the way, members of the committee, that happened in the Health Policy Committee. I think that amendment opens up a discussion that we have to have. I think there needs to be added flexibility. I think a simple opt-out like this, we need to address some of the other unintended consequences that if you do opt in, is there a certain time period that you have to be in the pool so you just can't go back and forth between different self-insured and pooled plans. Those are things that need to be discussed, but I think the foundation and the intention of this is something that we will follow and continue to represent the Health Policies Committee's concerns. And I do think there needs to be some flexibility for school districts to make sure that if there are concerns or cost increases, that they would anticipate that they are sheltered or shielded in some way.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stern.
I just wanted to mention that I will be supporting this bill, but Representative Winkler couldn't have stated it better. I have lots of problems with this bill, and I intend to be helping the author. I'll work through this one to get in the shape if it's going to be passed, but I'll be supporting it out of committee.
Representative Gumbel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of questions to ask of the testifier and the author, but we talked about unintended consequences and opt-ins. First question, Mr. Chair and Representative Hosh, is does this comply with the insurance requirements, reserves, consumer protection requirements under 62Q of law? And the reason I'm asking this is exactly the issue, Representative Winkler got at this earlier, that has been brought up time and time again about this legislation. Where are the protections? Where is the equity with other insurance programs in the state of Minnesota? And I'd love for you to point that out to me and show me how this matches up with the same requirements that we require of every other insurer in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald. I think these were some of the discussions that we had in the Health Policy Committee already in which the bill passed. But some of the things for building up the reserves, if you look at Section 8, which is outside this committee's jurisdiction, with reinsurance to
be able to build up reserves, MCHA assessments to make sure that the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Assessment isn't negatively impacted by this. All those things were concerns that were raised in the past and ones that were taken into consideration that were put into this legislation to try to come to a middle ground. I understand there's still more work to be done, but with those two very specific examples are ones that I think address some of your concerns.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the answer is basically no. It does not meet the requirements under 62Q. There have been some minor moves in that direction, but certainly not enough. And the concern there within our jurisdiction is we're talking about setting up a system that has the potential of putting taxpayers and others at risk. The other part I need to point out here, this is an unfunded mandate on more than half of our districts and certainly much more than half of our teachers. Commerce Department estimates today that 40 to 60% of our districts representing more than half of our teachers will pay more under this proposal. Now, I understand that we have issues concerning how we organize ourselves to provide affordable coverage for small districts, some of the districts that are experiencing difficulty. There are other ways. We don't need to do it with this approach, but forcing school districts to enter this, telling some that if they're self-insured before a certain date, but if they want to self-insure after that date, they're out of luck, is forcing an unfunded mandate on our school districts at a time when they can ill afford it. And that is my main reason for objecting to this bill. It's the reason that I moved to table it. This needs a lot more work before I would even consider voting for it.
Representative Kahn, were you on the list?
Yes.
All right, Representative Kahn.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, again, I find myself surprisingly in agreement with Representative Gottwald in historic first, but this entire bill does fall within the jurisdiction of this committee because we're setting up some complex that's bigger than any piece of state government that we've set up I don't know how long. I'm a little surprised, Mr. Chairman, because I thought that you had a very strong position at one point about not letting bills move out unless they were really, really ready to go. But, you know, as long as you're willing to waive that position, I guess I'm willing to follow.
We've waived no position.
Okay.
We stated no position. We have acted on a tabling motion, and the bill is before us, Representative Kahn.
Okay.
So I wish you would not characterize my position until I have characterized it. So, Representative Kahn, let's keep the characterization to the bill.
Okay, I'm sorry. But the what I just want to say is I, again, want to second the Winkler proposal that this bill is not in any shape to be passed, and the and I'm very concerned about having the opt-out position be complete and be fair and be workable. And I don't understand that if districts are moving to go into PEEP, why can't we let that just continue on a voluntary basis with an incentive, maybe rather than a requirement. But, you know, I am going to vote to move this bill on today, but with great reluctance and with a great belief that certain things that are incredibly important, like the opt-out position, needs to be kept.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Whenever the state mandates that some new organization be put together to serve a constituency, I would hope that we would be concerned about accountability of that new board or committee and how those who may be affected by their decisions might be able to interact with that board or committee and register their concern or complaint. This bill has been around a long time. I've raised this issue as long as 6 years ago, and I still see no provision here for accountability. Under the present system, if a teacher, school employee, doesn't like what is happening at the local level, they can move to change their negotiating committee, change the players. They can get active in school board elections and have some impact. I don't see anything by way of accountability in this bill. Representative Posh, am I missing something here? What happens if rank-and-file teachers or employees have some real concerns about the decisions that are being made by this committee. How can they go about affecting any change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Landing, in State Statute 15.0575, Subdivision 4, has different provisions for removal and vacancies, and the appointing authority can remove for cause members of that committee. So I would assume that the appointing authority, whether it be the school boards, or the Education Minnesota, or AFSCME, or SEIU, that if that membership has concerns, that that appointing authority can then remove their representation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, they have to go through an association or a group to affect change. They can't do it directly. Currently, they can do it directly. And I think that's a serious flaw with this. You know, I have concerns that this committee could easily, because we're not talking about folks who are experts in insurance policy, can easily be making decisions that adversely affect the rank and file out there. And the only way they can affect any change is to convince Education Minnesota or the School Boards Association to get rid of someone. That seems to me an inadequate means of accountability.
Representative Palin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hosh, I have concerns about the bill as well, but I think for reasons different than what we've heard, I think that the bill represents what we may see over the next 4 weeks here as we deal with a pretty profound budget crisis, and that is that I'm afraid that most of our bills are going to be victims of parochialism. Don't include my district because they're going to be affected over the next couple of years. Don't make this reform. Don't make that reform because my city or my school district is concerned. I think that I'm going to support the bill, and I want to encourage you to do the opposite of what I think other members have done, and that is that the bill doesn't go far enough. It doesn't actually, I believe, deal with the structural challenges facing our districts. And I say this with a district that we just we have a bill, I believe it's on the general register, that deals with a school district that is folding. One of my districts, if we don't succeed in our approach with our targets, faces a possible end as well, which I don't want to see. But I think we see more and more we see deals being made because people in this room say, "Don't hurt my constituency. Don't hurt this small group. Let people opt out. Healthcare, I don't serve on a committee, and I respect your judgment and your wisdom and your experience, Representative Hosh, a great deal. But we see this in the energy world. We see people, let us off-ramp. Let us opt out. Please, do the right thing. Deal with the healthcare mess before us so that we don't kick the can down the road and so that we really resolve this major pressure, one of three or four major pressures in our state budget and our school district. I want to thank you for carrying what I know has not been an easy bill to carry for all the concerns that other members have stated, but we need reform, we need it now, and we need to not delay just because we're hearing a little bit of pressure from this way or that. And I say this having a school district that is strongly opposed to the statewide plan.
Representative
Khan. Chairman, again, getting back to the sections that's under our control, where this appointing authority seems really kind of strange to me. Did you ever consider doing anything that would be much more reasonable, like having the governor make the appointments on the recommendation of these groups, which is how we usually do something that has this much statewide impact?
Representative Hosh or Mr. Johansson, who wishes to respond? Representative Hosh, you or Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Khan.
Mr. Johansson.
The model that we used is the Taft-Hartley Trust model, as Representative Hosh had indicated, where labor and management are represented in equal numbers, thus forcing them to do the work that otherwise would be done at the local collective bargaining table. And we're removing a great deal of discussion that would normally take place at the collective bargaining table, but we're putting the parties kind of in that same ratio of power in this committee. And I want to point out the committee is an advisory committee to the commissioner and PEEP, and then has the authority to approve any future plan design changes. But it isn't building this thing. It's taking on what has already been built.
But it is, again, the committee's structure has that creative tension in it that that reflects the party's interests back at the local.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't object to the creative tension and the structure of the committee. I just object to who makes the final appointments. For example, I think, and what happens in the model that you reference, who makes the final appointments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Conn, the collective bargaining agents and the employers make the appointments of the trustees into the Taft-Hartley Trust, which is what we have, the best we can do here. I mean, obviously, the School Board Association represents school boards, and so they're the ones that are doing that. The various unions represent the employees, so they're the ones that are doing that. So it's our attempt to make sure that, that those local interests are represented.
And
Representative Conn.
And you don't think you could have gotten that by having recommendations made to the governor and the governor making the final appointment?
Mr. Johns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Conn, we thought of that. We felt that it added one step of possible politicalization of the committee, and we believe that the parties that currently bargain should be the ones who appoint those people, and that's how we arrived at the decision.
Well,
Representative,
Mr. Chairman, the governor is the chief executive of the state, and I don't think one ought to accuse him of politicizing an important issue like this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Conn, I can see that it wasn't any one governor that I was speaking of.
Okay.
It's the position, but I appreciate your statement.
All right, Mr. Johansson, this was vetoed by the governor last year. What is the position of the governor this year on the revised bill, do you know? Or Representative Hodge?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the governor, I haven't seen specific communication from the governor's office on this bill yet. The Department of Commerce did identify some concerns, and as I stated earlier, the committee has my word that I will work to try to make this bill better. And I take Representative Conn, Representative Winkler, Representative Landings, and Representative Gottwald's comments and concerns to heart. And I will work to try to find some compromise. With that said, compromise doesn't always make everybody happy, but there are some legitimate concerns with this legislation. I will consider those. If the governor communicates any of those concerns, being the ultimate gatekeeper for this bill, I will definitely take those into consideration also.
Members, I renew my motion that House File 866 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Anderson?
No.
Diskin?
No.
Emma?
No.
Gottwald?
No.
Hilton?
Aye.
Hodge?
Aye.
Galen?
Aye.
Dittmeyer?
No.
Lanny?
No.
Marquardt?
Yes.
Morrow?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Hawkins?
Yes.
Sanders?
No.
Steiner?
Yes.
Winter?
Yes.
There being 10 ayes, 7 nays, motion prevails. Thank you. Next bill on the agenda is House. Well, we have a division report. Representative Nelson, division report on House File 1278.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the division report.
The division report has been removed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. House File 1278. I believe would go to the general register. So I will move House File 1278 to the general register. This bill is a division report. It was handled in division. We do have three testifiers. Representative, why don't you briefly explain the bill, and then we will get the testifiers up. Sir, Representative.
Okay, thank you, Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee. This bill is probably history is longer than I've been here, but it kind of came up as in our local government where we had Jackson County this year came to look at asking to do appointment of one of their positions, and the positions of recorder, auditor, treasurer,
and okay, and recorder. There's 27 counties in the state that have at least one of those positions being appointed over the years, and the first one started to be Hennepin County in 1967. So what this does is allows a process for the local counties with the 80% vote of the county commissioners to be able to change these positions into appointing from elected positions. And so I'm trying to make it being a process where it's a policy of the legislator rather than having individual counties come to us for permission each time to change it. Right now they could do a referendum, but sometimes those are costly in that, and the county commissioners are also are elected by the people, you know, each year that generally do the management committees or the management of that. And also I guess my feeling is that the city clerk of the cities, those are appointed positions, you know, currently, and not an elected official, because you have a city council members and a mayor that take that position.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. As Representative Sugar indicated, you've heard similar legislation before on a county-by-county basis. What we're looking for is a uniform authority for all counties to go through an open, transparent process by which they could make these positions appointed rather than elected. And what the bill contains is a requirement of an 80% vote of the county board, in addition to two public notices and a public hearing. And if that wasn't enough, we also included a petition and referendum process, which has been utilized three times in the past on county-by-county legislation to allow the public to weigh in directly. And with that, you know, we feel that there's adequate protection for the public. This is a change that we think the public ought to be involved in. We're trying to bring the discussion back into the county boardroom in the home county rather than here in St. Paul before the legislature on a county-by-county basis. And as Representative Sterner indicated, what we're seeing right now is smaller rural counties over time, as these jobs have become more technical and complex, are having a more difficult time finding folks to run for these offices that are qualified. And typically when you see the county-specific bills, there's a retirement pending or a death, unfortunately, in some cases. And so you'll see a county board that's very interested in appointing the assistant recorder, assistant auditor. And that person may or may not be willing to run, but they could very clearly be the best qualified person in the county to fill that position. And so that's kind of the background of where we're coming to you from. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Questions to the testifier. Let's say Mark.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. A couple things have been mentioned as reasons for this bill. And one is, Mr. Matthews, you stated that you want to get people involved. And current law, of course, gets people very much involved with a referendum.
Yes.
A second comment that was made by Representative Sterner, you said one of the reasons for this bill is that a city clerk in a city is appointed. Why not a auditor or recorder in a county? Police chiefs are appointed by cities. City attorneys are appointed or either put on contract. How come we're not extending this to sheriffs and county attorneys?
Mr. Matthews, do you wish to respond?
I would. Mr. Chair, as far as why we're not looking at the county attorney or county sheriff, that's frankly something that AMC has not taken a position on pursuing at this time. I personally think there's been a lot of discussion internally about the pros and cons of that. These positions specifically are viewed more as administrative positions. And these are people doing the work. They're preparing the county financial statements. They're doing the actual business. I think some might argue that the sheriff is maybe a slightly different than that of the county attorney, and I can't speak to that in more detail, unfortunately. Also, I just want to say, as far as the referendum process, we do have some counties where this issue has not been controversial. And in those cases, we feel, if the community feels that it's appropriate, that they don't have a referendum, that they don't need to go through that process. What we want to ensure is that the community knows that that's an option that's available. So if there is a controversy or if it is an issue, that they do then hold that referendum. But in some areas, that just hasn't been an issue, and the community's been supportive of the change.
Mark,
thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Well, I think one of the reasons we don't see sheriffs or attorneys in here would be a whole new animal, and it would create a huge bit of controversy. I'm not suggesting you should, but I do think there's a lot of politics. That's why you wouldn't take in sheriffs and county attorneys. But on lines 3.7 and 3.9 of the bill, it says each of these offices must be filled by election unless an office is consolidated with another county office. Does Representative Sterner, does that apply to sheriffs and county attorneys? Because it looks like it may, but I don't know for sure.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Markhart. This provision is just applying to the auditor treasurer position, which has been in a provision before where that can be a combined position. Many of the counties have that as a combined position already.
And finally, if I might, Mr. Chair, the last thing mentioned was that by holding elections, it's costly. And, you know, it's that by having the county boards decide this rather than taking it to a referendum, it saves on cost. Well, if we were to extend this to all elections, I mean, I think when it comes to democracy and people being able to vote for things, I don't think cost should really be a factor. And members, I know the way this is going to go, but I, you know, we have it in state law that counties can come in, well, counties can hold referendums and do that. And I still don't realize why. Of course, when I look at the chart here, I think I know why, because many times they're defeated. And I just think when you are taking a voting right away from a person, changing an elected position into appointed one, that should be the people deciding on a referendum. And this is the 20th time I've stated this view, and I'm going to lose again, Mr. Chair, but I just really am opposed to this.
Mr. Matt.
And Mr. Chair, just a quick response to that. We do have 46 counties in which none of these offices were opposed. And I think that's the concern that we're seeing going forward. It's not that we have an issue with those currently holding office. I think they're doing a wonderful job. The concern is down the road, there's a real issue of small counties not finding people interested in serving if they have to run for election. And I respect your position, Mr. Mark Corday.
Members, we have a couple other testifiers here, so if we could proceed. Michelle Ash. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Michelle Ash. I'm an elected county recorder, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Recorders. I'd also like to mention that we do have several other officers here in the audience today. The Recorders Association opposes this bill for many reasons. We do support Chapter 375A in its current form. One of the reasons for that is there are already methods in place for those counties that wish to change elected offices to appointed. And according to 375A, those are a referendum initiated by the county board, a referendum initiated by a recommendation of a government study commission, a referendum initiated by a petition of 5% of the voters of that county, or special legislation allowing the county to make that position appointed. By eliminating the referendum requirement, voters are denied the opportunity to exercise their voice. Because of this important issue of changing the form of local government, the state needs to leave the referendum requirement in place, or we risk devaluing the process. Some county officers are elected while others are appointed, but that choice needs to be left up to the voters and the taxpayers in each individual county instead of the county board. I respectfully ask that you oppose this House File 1278, and I'd be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Okay. Representative Khan, to this testify.
Yes. Doesn't the existence of the reverse referendum give the voters the choice just at a different level?
It does,
but the time frame is short, and we're not sure that that's the most effective.
Representative Khan.
Why is the time frame short?
Ms. Ash.
According to the legislation, they put a public notification in once, they put another public notification in, and then within 60 days there needs to be a petition turned into the county auditor. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how long the public notices are apart, but it looks like half a year to me. No, I
Ms. Ash.
Third of a year, 4 months or maybe.
Representative Sterner, you want to clarify?
Well, yeah, I guess we had this in committee. There was the positive direction from Representative Biskins and Representative Eastland and Representative Lanning. There was 30 days in the old form of the bill. We did extend it to 60 days to allow for notice and the public, you know, input on that, and I think that seemed to be a very positive change.
All right. We have any more questions to this testifier? Larry Jacobs. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Larry Jacobs, and I'm the Renville County Auditor-Treasurer. I also serve on the Board of Directors for the Minnesota Association of County Officers. I have been elected three times and have been in office since 1999. I'm in opposition to House File 1278 for the following reasons, and I've got four short points today. One, I really believe the voters want to choose their own representation. A case in point is last November in Redwood County, the vote was 2-1 against the commissioners appointing the auditor-treasurer. They wanted to do that. Number two is I believe that history shows that the voters ask the discerning questions during the election process to select the proper candidate. As an example, there are eight CPAs, I believe, and six former state auditors that hold the positions of auditor or auditor-treasurer in our state right now. So I do believe that the qualified person is sought out and fills that position. Number three is when I surveyed the voters in my area, the consensus of the voters is that an individual owes an allegiance to the person who gives them the job. And the elected person somewhat loses his independence if he's appointed by an administrator or four commissioners. The voters I talked to, they looked me right in the eye and they said, I want your allegiance to us, not to an administrator or not to four commissioners. That's the feel that I got when I surveyed my voters. And fourth, my last point is this proposed legislation changes the method by which the county organizational structure is determined. And it's extremely important to the voters. You know, if it isn't going to be left up to the voters of each county to decide how they should be governed, then we and I believe the legislators, through special legislation, should be involved in this process. Thank you. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Members, I think I have one more individual, Bob Bamanek. Welcome to committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Bob Bamanek, the Winona County Recorder. I've served in this position for 30 years. When I started, I was the youngest recorder in the state of Minnesota. Now it's probably on the other end. 2,000 signatures of registered voters. That's what's needed for a reverse referendum in Winona County. All the folks I've talked to say that's a pretty sizable challenge. And it's a challenge to continue a right and a privilege that we presently have. If there is reason to change, and many changes have been made in my office, I'll assure you, let's publicly discuss change and enable all county voters to decide. Let the county voters vote as it is in the present law. Thank you very much.
Question to the bill or to the testifiers? Representative
Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and thank you, Representative Cerner, for bringing a bill forward. I think the intention and the goal is a worthy goal. I understand that. But taking away something from the people is a very serious thing, and I don't see a sufficient problem to say we're going to take this away from the people. The other thing is that the very act of the campaigning part of that process is what keeps those folks close to their people. And when it comes to county work, it's especially close to the people, especially the chief election official, the county auditor, the recorder and land documents, and also you have the treasurer in regards to the actual finances. These are things that really pertain to them locally. And I don't see that it's an issue. Let the people, don't take things away from the people when you don't have to. And the worst thing to do it for is it's convenient for somebody else. I happen to think that in every county, there is somebody who is qualified and capable of doing that job, either within the office to rise into that position or somebody else from the outside. So I just don't see that this is a problem, and don't take this away from the people.
Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski and Representative Kipmeyer. I think the my key point is that we aren't taking away, we're just basically allowing the local government to have the control of it in the counties specifically. So if you have a county, you know, such as Grant County, that's very excited about keeping elected officials, it's based up to Grant County, but rather than each county come back to us, we're allowing the process to either be by referendum if the county decides to do that, or if they decide with an 80% vote to be able to do that from the county commissioners. And the people still have the right to elect and not elect their county commissioners as well.
All right. Further discussion to the bill. Seeing no further discussion, anyone else wish to testify for or against it? This bill was handled in division. All right, Representative Sterner, to your motion that House File 1278 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Chairs in doubt. All those who wish to support the motion, please raise your hand. All right, let's keep our hands up just to make sure folks. We've got to turn it. All right, we have it. All right, all those opposed. There being 7 ayes and 9 nays, motion does not prevail. The bill is defeated. The next bill on the agenda is House File 222. Representative Flowick. Flowick, I believe I'm going to move that House File 222 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. I believe there is a clarifying delete everything amendment. And I'll move the DE1 amendment, and out of courtesy to the author, let's put the bill in the shape that it needs to be in. So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. Representative Flowick, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I want you to know that the delete all addresses all the concerns that we've heard, and I appreciate the staff pulling it together. There are three things in this bill that it does. First, it allows access for the senators in the non-campaign years to apartments and multiple unit facilities. Second, it allows access when candidates have filed a financial report as required by Section 211A. And third, this includes the motion amendment, which is on the back page of the delete all, line 2.7.
Questions to the bill as amended? This has been before us before, so. Seeing no questions, anyone wish to testify for or against the bill? I will then move House File 222 as amended, be recommended to pass, and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Thiessen. House File. There's a number of Thiessen bills here, so let's make sure we're dealing with the correct one. House File 884. And House File 884 has to go to the Finance Committee. So I will move House File 884 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Thiessen, to your bill and why it's been gabbed.
There, Mr. Chair, actually there's a DE1 amendment.
I will move the DE1
and,
amendment.
And before you do, Mr. Chair, I do have two modifications to the short ones.
All right, let's see the modification.
On line 1.9, take out the word and equipment, the first two words. And on line 1.10, take out the words private and.
Mr. Shepherd. let's make those modifications in the amendment, and then I will propose the amendment with the modifications. Mr. Shepard, do those work?
Mr. Chair, yes.
All right. Does everybody understand the modifications in the DE1 amendment? All right. I will then propose the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Mr. Representative, then why is the bill before us?
Mr. Chair, because the Department of Administration is in charge of this purchasing program, and I think that falls within the jurisdiction of your committee.
All right.
And basically what we're doing, we currently have a prescription, we buy prescription drugs in bulk through this multi-state government contracting alliance. We just want to expand their authority to purchase supplies, medical supplies.
Mr. Rhodes, do you want to, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, Jim Rhodes, Department of Administration. The MNCAP program services about 46 states plus L.A. and Chicago, and it's very successful, and we are working with the author to make this legislation work for him, and we'll take the rest of the changes and deal with it in the Finance Committee. So.
All right. Any further, Representative Gubbel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good bill. Thank you.
Further discussion to the bill is amended. Representative Con-
just the conceit, I guess, never mind, it's just finance questions.
This is going to finance, yes. Members, so we're more concerned about the makeup of certain elements, but not necessarily the finance part of it. All right, seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 884, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The second Thiessen bill is House File 986. This is a division report. So, Representative Nelson.
Chair, I'd like to move the division report.
Representative Nelson moves the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. House File 986. I will move the recommended pass, and this has to be referred to the Finance Committee. So, Representative Thiessen to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there is a an A090367 amendment.
I will move the Representative Thiessen. I've got three different amendments here. I have a 367, a 330, and now a 382 has been passed out.
The 367 and the 330 are mine. The 382 is actually an amendment to the 366 amendment. So there's like an amendment to the amendment. Those are not mine. So the two amendments that are mine are the 330 and the 367.
All right, so the first one we want to deal with is the 367?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Right, I will move the 367 amendment. So why don't you explain that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this amendment, I think the reason that the bill is before the committee is on Article 2, which is this county governance reform. And what the 367 amendment does, different from basically some of the concerns were raised in local government, this is addressing those. Sets in the first sections there, like 1.3 to 1.17, much more stringent requirements for being able to withdraw from this county agency, state-county cooperative, these agreements that are, state-county cooperative agreements, these human service authorities. The second section redefines the powers of the council and who's going to serve on the council, so that there's more balance between the counties and the states. This will make more sense when I describe the bill, I suppose. 2.15 and 2.16 address Representative Biskin's concerns raised in the last committee about how we mediate conflict. So it's basically to get the bill in the shape that I'd like it, and then maybe I can discuss it more detail when we have more context.
All right. Then let's vote on the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So now to the bill is amended.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is setting up a state-county governance framework, and it's kind of an alternative, in a sense, to some of the proposals we've heard about consolidation of human services in the counties. What this bill is about is kind of making sure that we honor function over form. and which meaning that instead of kind of creating the form of putting counties together and then letting the functions flow from that, we're going to build on what's actually happening in the counties, which is that a lot of cooperation is actually going on today, and this would just allow two things, really. It would allow that innovation to continue in a more formulaic way that we can perhaps build and bring to scale more quickly, and it also creates a different relationship between the states and the counties. Right now, I think we have somewhat of a top-down approach from the state's relationship with the counties. This would hopefully create more trust and relationship and working together between our counties and our state government as we deliver particularly human services. And so what it does is it allows for agreements to be formed between, kind of like joint powers agreements, but between counties, but also have the state as a partner in those agreements. And it sets forth goals for that authority in terms of performance outcomes that they have to meet. And so what it does is kind of bring everybody together, figure out this is what we have to accomplish, and then in that group of counties for that particular function, they're going to be able to say, and this is how we're going to accomplish it, working together. It creates an oversight council, which is really why this bill, I think, is before this committee, which puts members of the state, including DHS, and appointees of the governor, as well as members, representatives of counties, to come together and kind of work through these agreements and assess whether they make sense in a particular particular area, and I think it actually is a strong model for us to move forward in terms of innovating how we deliver service at the county level, being more efficient. And I'll just let Mr. Harder explain a little more if that's all right.
All right, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Kelly Harder. I'm the Human Service Director in Steele County. I'm also co-chair for the MACSA organization, and I come here on behalf of MACSA and also the Association of Minnesota Counties. Coming on behalf of the counties, which you might not hear very often, but, you know, we're saying we embrace this change, we embrace the opportunity, and we want you to hold us accountable. We want to be accountable, we want to be transparent, and we want to bring that value to the taxpayer that we all work very hard to show in the day in the life of. We're here in front of the committee, and I won't go back over what Representative Tiefen did a really nice job describing the framework of the bill. In particular, this council, which I think is of most interest here. The importance to this council is it's the structure that brings forth the accountability. There is a lot of tension right now, unfortunate tension, between the department and the county operations system. The bottom line is we need to work together because it's the residents of this state who benefit and or suffer when that isn't happening well. And we want this, we need this council in the context of the redesign for that accountability. This council does not in any way, shape, or form, as we have it proposed, take any authority away from any department commissioner, any representative, anyone. It's merely an oversight structure that makes recommendations. We currently have a bill also traveling through the Senate and the House on chemical dependency redesign. It is a systems redesign initiative. We've met with the department. At this point, they are unwilling to engage the solution to bring forth that very change. This is the reason we need the council. I'm told one day we'll work together. 2 days later, I'm told we don't know that we can support this bill. But I can't even get them at the table to redline the bill that we have proposed to know what are the issues. If we're going to have systems reform, we believe it has to happen at the program level, and that will eventually create the very system that we all want to achieve and will achieve. But we need this council to have that oversight to make sure all systems funded by the taxpayer are held transparent, accountable, and the quality we all deserve. Thank you very much.
Let's then go on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope we'll have some time for the department to respond to that. I noticed that Assistant Commissioner Wilkin is present. But I also understand that the governor has proposals around health and human services in this area. And I want to understand how this bill jibes with what he's proposing, either complements it or disagrees with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Commissioner Wilkin will be able to describe some of that. In committee, in our policy committee on health and human services, we heard this legislation, and actually the governor does have a proposal to essentially set up 15 kind of joint service authorities delivering human services. And so the governor's proposal is essentially saying we could look at a map of Minnesota, draw out the lines of where all human services should be delivered, and then do that, and then let those groups figure out how best to do it. And what this proposal is saying instead is saying the counties are already doing a lot of this cooperative work right now, and in fact, what may work in one service delivery area, you know, whether it's child support, for instance, with this group of counties may not be the same group of counties where it makes sense to deliver chemical dependency services. So we're starting at the function level and saying we ought to build from the function level what's already going on and build up to this cooperative service agreement, which this bill does, as opposed to saying we should draw up the lines on the map first and then let everything fall from there. And the other difference, I think, is the council that's really at the heart before this committee right now, which is to get the counties and the states together in a more formal fashion so that they can actually work together to move forward. So those, I think, yeah.
Mr. Hardis? Yes, Mr. Chair, well, let me specifically also answer the comparison of side-by-side on the council. In the governor's proposal, their structure is that of the counties and the state, not a lot different like it happens right now. They would present what they refer to as what's called a shack redesign model, which was when public health did some redesign previously. What's different there is the population was 30,000, which the counties originally have proposed that the redesign be focused around populations of 30,000, consistent with community corrections redesign, as well as public health. The other fundamental difference there is that when shack redesigned, the Department of Human of Public Health at the state level also redesigned. And they gave funding for the redesign. None of that exists in the governor's proposal. And this, our proposal we bring, actually brings the department and the counties at more of an equal footing to bring forth the creative ideas of redesign, not one over the other, but yet accountability.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I can't quite, is this council essentially in the Department of Human Services?
Representative Pease. Madam Chair, it's chaired by the Department of Human Services. I would say it's not within the Department of Human Services per se, though. I mean, the department, the Commissioner of Human Services is one of the chairs, but it doesn't fall within the Department of Human Services.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a minor amendment I'd like to propose. That's on line 8.24, the one-word amendment.
All right, Representative, why don't you propose the amendment, and I don't know, Mr. Shepherd is going to take your amendment,
okay,
and then we'll see if it works.
Okay, I'd like to change the legislative research, I'd like to change the must to may. I don't think we ought to have an executive agency bossing around legislative staff, and you have legislators on, they're quite capable of requesting that.
I'm fine with that.
All right. And does it work? And you'll give it to Mr. Sanders.
All right. So Representative Kahn moves the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Chair, I actually have one technical amendment.
All right.
As well, on the actual, on the 367 amendment that we added, on line 2.18, I think the word should be deliver instead of delivery.
2.18, it should be plan and
deliver services.
Plan and deliver services.
So I don't know.
I'll move that amendment.
Thank you.
Any discussion to that amendment?
All right.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. President Gumbel.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if we could hear from Assistant Commissioner Wilkin at this point. Thank you.
Members, there is another committee in here at 10:30. Just so everybody knows. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tim Wilkin, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Human Services. I thank you for your time. I'll try to be quick and keep it high level. The bill that is before you is designed to, just like the governor's proposal, change how we deal as Department of Human Services with the counties. That proposal was started because of the legislative auditor report on County and State Human Services Administration. In that, they recognized that the current construct was developed in 1973 that encouraged multi-county administration of human services. Since that time, over 30 years ago, we've had five counties take us up on that with two different groups, Lincoln, Lyon, Murray, and Faribault-Martin. they commented that clearly it is not working, not because those groups are failing. They've actually recognized savings and efficiencies. But the OLA cited that the reason that counties cite that they don't do this is because there are no requirements, there are no financial incentives from the state, and the mergers are politically difficult. The governor's proposal proposes financial incentives for that. Our main concern with this bill is that there are no financial incentives. This bill actually does not move us forward. It actually creates some additional hurdles in the place of counties who would want to engage in a multi-county collaborative. It adopts another step that these counties who want to collaborate must go in front of this oversight council. It also creates an additional three-step annual timetable that was kind of borrowed from our bill, but it really doesn't work with this bill. In our bill, that was the timetable that was established for qualifying for the incentive money to get that back into the system to for the counties that participate. There's also no mechanism in this bill to address counties that want to participate in a multi-county system but have not been able to find a partner. There's no way to assign them in such case. There's no similar mechanism for counties that aren't performing based on the performance measures. The changes in here to the current governance system, we have a county-administered state-supervised system, and it's all well and good for counties to want to be on an equal playing field with the state, but the state has a role in supervising and creating policy, whereas the counties deliver the services. They're the operational units. And that if you upset that system, it's kind of like saying, well, we want to be on equal footing with the federal government. It doesn't work too well that way. If you have a mediation system where counties can question every decision made by the commissioner, we'll have a constant churn where we have delayed decision-making. And when you get into something like licensing, where the commissioner is making decisions on licensing of child care centers and in-home child care, where we often have violations where children are at risk or vulnerable adults are at risk, if counties disagree with the commissioner, you might see delays in actual enforcement in those orders. I would have you look at the governance agreements and the service level agreements. I think the intent of the counties is to set up themselves to have more equal playing field with the state, but what it sets up is more of a conflict because we our role and the county role is set up in statute. That's not kind of up for negotiation. Any governance agreement we have will have to reflect statute, and I anticipate county unhappiness with that unless the statute is currently changed. Also, as far as service level agreements, the service levels provided by DHS are subject to appropriations. If we don't have an appropriation for something that the county wants, we're just going to have to say no, and counties, I think, will get frustrated that nothing changes. To give you an example, in the last few weeks with the deficiency bill, there is a proposal that would have taken $12 million of our systems account, systems that need to be developed to support county activity. If that's gone in the legislative process, we're not going to be able to stick by service level agreements that might be created. Also, we have the governor's proposal has actually changed over time, and I know that's not in front of you, but I did want that acknowledged that it's no longer 15. If we took the hard number out, we took the number that for standalone counties down from a 250,000 population to 65,000 population. We've made substantial changes. We hope to continue that discussion going into the Finance Committee. And I know you're pressed for time, so I'll just stand for questions.
I put Representative Teese in the spot. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I will be the first to acknowledge that Governor Plenty has been a driving one of the driving forces behind this, and we appreciate that. On the Faribault Martin and the Lincoln Lyon Murray, again, this comes back to, do we start with the map or do we start with the function? And I think we should start with the function. I would say one of the counties in the Faribault Martin, there was actually three originally. One of them dropped out because it wasn't working for them. so that you can, they can get out even under the kind of current world. Additional hurdles is not true, because you can still proceed to get joint powers agreements and move forward without going through the advisory council. All the current laws that we have about how counties can work together will continue to exist. We just think that coming through this advisory council will actually improve matters. The financial incentives that were discussed are actually money that the state is going to hold back from counties and then give to them if they actually merge and do what was proposed in the governor's council. So calling that new money or financial incentives is a little bit, I think, inaccurate. And I guess the last thing is, I don't think that this is a situation where it's going to get in the way of cooperation or get in the way of DHS doing licensing. I mean, these are situations where DHS is going to be at the table and discussing these things with the counties. The contract is going to lay out all the information and all the ways that the details that that would work out. And at the end of the day, the people in this room are in charge of setting what the rules of what the law is. So,
Representative Gellar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to, perhaps to both Representative Thiessen and Assistant Commissioner Wilkin, are these irreconcilable differences? Are these things that we can work out? Or?
And Mr. Chair, I would say the counties and the department have continued to work. One of the reasons for the amendment you saw today is because of some movement I think the counties are making to the Palencia, to the governor's proposal. And I think that, you know, and ultimately this is actually Lauren Tolbert. So he'll be involved in working through it as well. But we'll continue to talk and figure out the best way, because I think everybody is interested in changing the way, especially with how human services funding is going to be cut and how LGA perhaps is going to, and other county aids are going to be cut. The counties are going to have to do this kind of redesign work anyway. I think fundamentally the key is that the state and the counties need to work together better than they do today, and this is where this bill is going.
Representative Kiffmeyer, I want to remind members, 10:30, there is another committee coming in. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Thiessen, I just wanted to clarify one section of the bill. And I'm also very glad to hear of the working relationship and making things better as we go along. But if I read right, 12-17-12-16, this looks like an absolute exempt from levy limits, because I look at this and say there is, everything is underneath this. So this would exempt counties from the levy limits in its entirety.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, this would any when they, if they were to go through this process and form this human services, and I always forget what this thing is called, I'm sorry, this cooperative agreement, those duties would be exempt from the levy limits as it says in here. And so we'll probably have to go to taxes too, I guess.
Representative Thiessen, that's a probability.
Yes.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
That's
all right. That's right, Representative.
Further discussion to the bill.
I have one other amendment.
Which amendment is that one?
That's the 330, which is totally separate from everything we've discussed so far.
I got the 330. Representative, I will move the 330. Why don't you explain what it is?
Mr. Chair, if I could just drop in some numbers, because it was drafted. So on line 1.1, House File 986. Should be filled in there.
All right.
And on line 12, or 1.2, excuse me, it should be page 12 after line 30. And then after line 1.2, it should say we should insert Article 3. And then on line 1.15, there's a blank for the section. It should say Section 1. I don't know. Maybe they can just do that.
I think Ms. Dyson's got it.
Okay.
And
all right, that's
with
fine.
That clarification, I'll move the amendment.
Okay.
So, why don't you explain why we need the amendment?
What the amendment does, Mr. Chair, is it sets up one of the things I think that we don't do so well in the state is two things with our nonprofits and how we deliver services to nonprofits. And that's first to bring stuff to scale. We have a lot of nonprofits working on and doing really good work on a local level, but we need to be able to bring those things to scale statewide or region wide much more effectively. And the second thing is, I think that our nonprofits actually, one thing we also don't do well is kind of try to put in place a plan where they become self-sustaining more readily. And so what this bill does is it sets up in the Office of Grants Management, or what this amendment does, the Office of Grants Management, a commission on innovation, which is going to look for how we can, as a start, it was a much bigger bill at first, but how we can start down the process of rethinking how we do grants and actually maybe awarding some grant money that would allow us to bring really good ideas to scale and make more assessments about what's working and what's not working. And that's kind of essentially what it does. Aye. To the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Now we have the bill as amended. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I will move that House File 986 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Coles has been waiting somewhere. There he is. Representative Coles, House File 834. I will move that House File 834 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, there's an A1 amendment to put the Senate language into House File 834, and I think it's a great amendment. I'd appreciate you moving it.
I will move the A1 amendment. Why don't you tell us the substance of the amendment? Is there
The substance of the amendment, simply line 1.2, it makes sure that we keep any expenditures in the same fiscal year, and the second would delete the last sentence and replace it with a direction that the money be spent from the account where the savings are accrued.
Discussion to the amendment. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Cole, see your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Very briefly, House File 834 represents what I think unfortunately doesn't happen around here often enough, and that's we often think we have the best ideas, or the lobbyists around here think they have the best ideas. This is actually an idea that came from a constituent of mine, somebody I've never met. He's on my email list, and like many of you, I send out email updates to my constituents, and in early January, I sent out an email update talking about some of the challenges that the state was facing from a budget perspective. This gentleman emailed me back with an idea that he had. He had seen it when he was an airman in the U.S. Air Force to provide an incentive for employees to offer cost savings ideas. I just want to read one sentence from his email. He said, anyway, with money as tight as it is right now, I figure any reasonable suggestion from anyone that could save us some money should be worth considering. As a result of his email, I asked that House File 834 be drafted. Since that time, I've again sent out email correspondence to my email list, my constituents, and I've heard back from another constituent who happens to be a consultant and has seen these types of programs in action, both in the private sector and in the public sector, and he was hoping to be here today to provide some testimony. Unfortunately, his daughter has had surgery today and wasn't able to be here. He did testify in the Senate. Members, the bill is simple. It's straightforward. As it says, if a state employee offers a cost-saving idea and that cost-saving idea is implemented, they will receive a one-time incentive payment of up to 10% of that cost savings with a cap of $2,500. I think it's a way to get state employees to buy in to some of not only the challenges that we're facing this year, but challenges that I think we're going to continue to see as a state in the near term. With that, Mr. Chair, that's the bill. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
And again, members, 10:30, there's another committee. Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I agree with you. It's a good idea. In fact, I think it's such a good idea that I recall that Representative Welty had almost the exact same bill in 2007, and I'm wondering if staff knows about the bill, or if you know about that bill and remember the status of what happened. I think it was very, very similar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I'm not familiar with Representative Welty's bill. I take your word at it, and I hope that Representative Welty will help me pass this one.
Representative Mark.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, this is a great piece of legislation. Probably the best bill you've ever brought forward. But no, I would say from experience, in Dilworth we did this. And in fact, we offered 15% to the employee and 15% to the group or department that was impacted. But the employees know best where the savings are. And so this is a wonderful piece of legislation.
Representative Double.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that our company actually does this exact sort of thing, and a lot of companies do, and they do it for a reason. It saves money. It finds best practices. It uses, as Representative Markworth pointed out, the expertise and the knowledge of the trenches, working nature of any organization to make it better. So, good bill.
All right, members, seeing no further discussion, Representative Kahn.
Just a question in the amendment that you just put on, the first fiscal year, what happens if the, how does that work? That means that any employee who has a suggestion or to hold it out till the beginning of the fiscal year, because if they have an idea in December or whenever the fiscal year is ending, it's clearly not going to...
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, my intent is that it be a one-time payment. So if we need to work on some language to fix that, I got this language from Senator Roebling. The bill is on the floor in the Senate, and this is language that they worked out in committee there. If there's a need to tighten that up or to fix that, Representative Kahn, I'd be happy to do that. But the intent is that it would be a one-time incentive payment to the employee. And that language was intended to capture that idea. But if we need to work on that, I'm happy to do so.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cole, what's the department's position on this bill?
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, they have not contacted me in support or in opposition. There were two committee hearings in the Senate, and I don't believe they testified at either. So it's my understanding they're neutral.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole, that's very interesting. Representative Kalin brought up a bill that was very similar to the sponsored by Representative Welty, and I, as a result of that, since it dealt more specifically with energy savings, I had innumerable conversations with the Department of Administration about that bill and about the difficulty of documenting any kinds of cost savings. And I suggest that maybe you should have a conversation with the Department of Administration, because I'm sure they recall all of the objections they had to Representative Welty's bill, and I will try to recall all of those also when I get the finance if this bill passes out of this committee.
Representative Hilty, thank you for reminding us. This goes to finance, and that type of a reminder should be brought to the department. If it's for one, it should be good for all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I will absolutely have a conversation with the department. Thank you.
Any further discussion to the bill's amendment? Representative Merrill, did you have a Representative Merrill?
I'll do it also.
All right. Any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 834, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying all. Saying aye. Any opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move that House File 1206 be recommended pass and be placed on the general register.
Representative Simon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I'll be real quick here. Members, this bill began as Section 14 of what we're about to put on. I have a DE1 amendment. I should mention that.
Yes, why don't you move the DE1?
Okay, I move the DE1 amendment, members, to get the amendment that I'd like.
And why don't we put the amendment on out of courtesy to the author. So all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. Representative Simon,
thank
the bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quickly, this bill began as Section 14. The bill that those of you who have been on the committee have seen before, it passed unanimously before. All it does is establish a contribution limit for judicial elections. Believe it or not, there isn't one right now. It's a great big oversight. And we just establish it at the same level as the governor, which is the highest on the ladder, which is 2,000 in the election year, 500 in other years. That's the bill. That's never had any controversy. What happened in the Senate was the companion bill is being carried by Senator Rest. She elected to place onto it by amendment the technical or housekeeping bill of the campaign finance board. And so in order for those changes to make it, that had to be done to this bill as well. And for that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Goldsmith.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through the bill section by section, but rather concept by concept, so as to leave some time for members' questions. The bill deletes certain constitutional provisions that have remained in the statute from since 1988, also one obsolete provision. Those are sections 1, 15, 19, and 22. Those four sections have never been enforced since the court rulings made them unenforceable, and in some cases the board is restrained from enforcing them. This is cleanup language so that we no longer have to explain to people why they don't have to comply with those particular provisions. A more substantive change at the request of the board, and this is in the board's effort to streamline its operations, to do what the governor and others have suggested, and that is look for ways that we can save money, operate with a limited staff. We're going to be operating with 8 staff rather than 9 as we go forward. And so sections 3, 5, 6, 8, and 13 all remove a certified letter request that triggers a late filing fee. I'd like to just explain that a bit. First of all, late filing fees in all programs don't begin until 10 days after the due date, so there's a grace period. Under the current statute, once that 10 days has expired, the board has to send a certified letter, and that triggers a very minimal late filing fee, $5 per day up to a maximum of $100. After that, another certified letter is sent, and then a $100 per week civil penalty can begin. What the board's proposing is that we eliminate the first certified letter, so the late filing fee would start automatically, but not till 10 days after the due date for any particular report. Our practice already, and we will continue and enforce, continue and enhance that practice, is to use the telephone as a means of getting those reports in. We find it actually more effective than a certified letter. And so for this initial late filing fee, we think it's appropriate to eliminate that. And that would represent a cost savings of about $6,000 to the board in an election year when everybody is up for election. There would still be a certified letter to the treasurer before the civil penalty at $100 per week begins. The bill also includes 2 initiatives to allow the board to move really far into the 21st century and to begin to take advantage of technology, again, to allow the board to continue to maintain its operations and its level of service with a reduced staff. And those are 2. In Section 7, people filing political committees or funds with the board would be required to provide an email address if they have one. That's the extent of the change. It doesn't change the way the board gives notice to people or how we would use that email address. And Section 9 provides an exemption for good cause, and I'll have more to say about what good cause is. But if you don't have email, don't have internet, don't have a computer, of course you're going to be exempt. The reason is so that we can start to develop a database of emails so that we can then look at how those email addresses might be used, whether there are some cases in the statute where it might be either through board initiative or legislative action might be appropriate to change certain notices to electronic. But at this point, we can't tell you how wide the database will be or how fast it changes and how accurately we can maintain those email addresses. The second initiative regarding technology has to do with electronic filing, and that's the reason this bill was delayed in reaching you. I thank Representative Simon and the committee and the chair for hearing the bill today. We have worked out with caucuses, party units, and anyone else who expressed concerns to us about the electronic filing requirement. We've worked out the problem so that we believe we have support all around. I'd like to spend a little bit of time saying a little bit more about what that particular provision is. First of all, and this is Section 10. First of all, the provision goes into effect for the election year 2012. The provision does not say that parties, candidates, and so on must file their reports using the board software. What the provision says is they must file electronically in a format that the board will specify. And another provision, at least for party units, says the party units and the caucuses have to approve that format. Looks like the first format we'll develop will be an XML-based format. What that does is it produces a text file that anybody can look at, word processor, so you'll actually be able to see what the data is that goes to the board. As far as the electronic filing, there'll be several ways to do it, and there'll be an exemption procedure. For the biggest filers, party units, and caucuses, they typically use commercial software, and those commercial vendors have told us that they welcome an XML standard. They're prepared to implement it, and there's really not any extra cost because they already do it for other states. For other filers, there will be free software provided by the board. It will look a lot like the software that many of you use now, except for the fact that the report that gets sent to the board will be completely different. Right now, it's a database, and unless you have Microsoft Access, you can't look at its contents. Under the new filing system and the new standard the board has to provide, you will actually be able to look at that file in a word processor and see exactly what the text is that's going to the board. And in fact, when you look at it, you'll see it's essentially the same text as would go on a paper report, except each field will be bracketed with a little tag that says what kind of data is in that field. Thirdly, the board will be developing an online system where those people who find it simplest just to fill out a paper report, if they have internet access, would be able to go to a website, key the same data into an online form, and file that form and meet the requirement. We already do that in PDF, and a lot of people use it, actually. They go online and file their fill out their PDF forms, but then they print them and fax them because we don't have an electronic system. And finally, there will be certainly a group of people who are exempt. The provision is that the board must provide a waiver for good cause. And there are more than 400 instances in the statutes where the legislature has used good cause as a standard for an agency or board or body to either do or not do something. And in no case do they actually define that, save one that I found in the child protection type situations. Good cause, according to courts, essentially means you have a good reason. It can't be a frivolous reason. It can't be sort of, I just don't like the idea. But certainly, if you don't have reliable internet access. The board recognizes how valuable treasurers are to committees. If you have a treasurer who doesn't use a computer, that person isn't going to be required to buy a computer or learn to do it. They can continue to do their filing the way they want to, the way they've always done it. We've actually found that if you look at people who have registered committees from 2001 to the present, the rate of use of our current software is double the rate of use by those persons who filed in 2000 or earlier. And not only is the rate double, but the numbers are much greater because the older committees tend to terminate. And so we're already getting penetration, but this will set the direction for the board. It will set the direction for our technology staff, where they're going to go, where our emphasis will be. What this will do is, number one, it will make our data more accurate. It will allow us to continue to function with fewer staff that we'll have as we move forward. We did build in significant...
We're right up against the time limit here, and we have further bills.
I will stop there and stand for questions.
Representative
Tom. Mr. Chairman, on page 5, line 5.3, I noticed you require the address of the candidate of a principal campaign committee. We've just passed a bill through this committee. I don't know if it's 653 or 655 that I had, which allows circumstances under which that address may be kept private. Does this interfere with that in any way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I don't think so. The board's position has always been that a person may use either their personal address or a business or committee address, so it doesn't have to be home address. They may use either their personal address or a business or committee address, so it doesn't have to be home address. And we also have provisions already in our legislation to make that private if they want to.
All right, Representative Sterner.
Thank you. To another point in the bill, I work with Mr. Gearing, but Representative Swales offered a bill about campaign non-campaign disbursements. So we had an amendment that went on her bill. That's the language on the beverage utensils is in here, but the my amendment isn't in here, and I'm just wondering if you would take it as a friendly amendment to the bill.
Representative Simon, do you have the amendment now, Representative Simon?
Very quickly here, Mr. Gary.
It's going to be really quick.
It's right there. You have it right now.
Why don't we clarify whether or not we need the amendment on this bill, but Representative Simon.
Regarding PayPal fees, allowing those to be non-campaign disbursements for
that. Mr. Chair, I don't think that's needed for this bill. We did pass that bill separately, and... this is the first time hearing of it. I don't think it's
Representative Sterner, I don't believe you'd really need it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Representative Simon, Chair Paul.
Further questions? Representative Gutwald, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, just to comment, too, I know this is kind of we've got a DE1 amendment here that's basically an omnibus election bill, if you will, suddenly dropped on us, but
Under section 6.16 to 6.18, page 6, I'm just trying to understand what you're doing there and why we're basically saying, as I understand it, that if one party fails to file the report, the other party gets to keep their information private or non-public. And to me, that kind of breaks down transparency, but maybe you can help me understand what's going on there.
Mr. Goldsmith. Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, yes, this came through negotiation with the caucuses in particular, and both caucuses were concerned. What happened during the last election cycle, in fact, was that one caucus filed their report on time and the other filed late with, we don't know why, whether it was intentional to gain an advantage by seeing what the opposing caucus was doing or not. So what the caucuses requested is that there are two sort of provisions. One is if one caucus files and the other doesn't, the board will publish information indicating who filed and who did not. The filer may release their records either themselves or authorize the board to release it, but the public will know that the reason that the report of the filer has not been released is because one of the caucuses didn't file. We think that this actually provides a lot of pressure on that non-filing caucus to get their report filed. But the corresponding provision is if one files electronically and one does not, they will both be released in a viewable format, but not in electronic data that could be manipulated until the board can make them both available in that format. This was something that was reached, as I said, in negotiation with the caucuses.
Okay.
Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion. The House Bill 1206, as amended, be placed on the general register.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. We have two division reports. Representative Nelson, the first division report on House File 1670.
I'd like to move the division report.
Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. House File 1670, Representative Mariani was here. Tell me he is still there. He is. Representative Mariani, will move that House File 1670 be recommended to passage be placed on the general register. Two-year bill.
Mr. Chair, I believe that perhaps Representative Nelson's vote, but I can't move. Can I? As a
no.
Member of the committee? I'd be glad to move it.
Repeat that. I'm not too sure.
I'm trying to make sure for the record that someone from the committee was moving, making this
one. The division report was moved and adopted. Once the division report was adopted, we had the bill. I then moved your bill, so your bill is
very
up,
well.
And it's going to the general register. However, given our time limits, we can do something else with it.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll take 30 seconds. This bill clarifies the ability of locals to enforce affordable rent agreements that arise out of agreements between locals and developers as a condition of receiving public subsidies precisely that purpose. We had a good discussion, Representative Nelson's division. We actually amended and tightened up the language. Very good work. I have Councilwoman Amy Ireland from Mobile here with us. If there are any questions regarding the particulars of the bill.
Okay, questions to the bill. Representative Hill.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that we did thoroughly vet this bill in division. I think that when the discussion in division and the amendments that were added went on, everybody was thoroughly satisfied that the bill in its current form ought to pass, and I recommend that to the committee.
Further discussion? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 1670 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Mayor.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson, another division report.
Senate File 740, I'd like to move the division report.
Representative Nelson moves the division report on Senate File 740. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. I will move that Senate File 740 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Abler.
30 seconds. It's a good bill. This is a design build pilot for two counties in North and Dakota to create the necessary bridge in the city of Ramsey, and I'm not so clear on the Dakota project, but it's Representative Morgan still. We've adopted all the language that was asked for us by the contractors and relative to the Hortman proposal, and
We'll stand for questions.
Okay, Representative Kalin, you have a question?
Mr. Chair, members, I continue to have concerns about design build and the protection against litigation. A lot of you remember the lawsuits in the wake of the 35W bridge. I see that some of the language on a bill that I worked on last year and came to an agreement with the department on is in the pilot project. I don't see all of it, and I urge members to proceed cautiously. I will be voting no, because I don't think that it actually meets the needs of the two projects. I think they're proceeding nicely, and I think that they will be more costly and actually slow down the project because of the litigation exposure, and we should be very, very cautious about going outside the design bid build low bid process.
Members, this is a division report. Representative Nelson, was there any controversy in the division?
There was discussion in the committee. There were some questions about whether this would jump it ahead on the stiff list for the transportation projects. We were assured by the county or the city of Ramsey that they were not going to seek state funding, so they were going to be seeking private and local funding for this bridge. And there were safety, the reason for it, there were safety issues involved as far as their fire department and emergencies is on one side of the tracks, and the majority of the development that they're trying to protect is on the other side of the tracks. And this is the trackage that the North Star is going to be running on, and they'll be, during rush hour, it'll be 6 minutes apart on some of those trains, and so they have a concern about getting the emergency services across this trackage.
I'm concerned about the low bid language. Mm-hmm. Haven't we kind of moved to a best bid or a best responsive bid or that kind of thing in a lot of places?
Representative Adler, or do you want to?
I think my mayor can speak.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bob Ramsey, the mayor of Ramsey. This whole intent of getting this done is y'all are probably aware that we did purchase the town center development. Most, like I said, there's a public safety issue here. This is a grade-to-grade crossing. There isn't another way of getting across the tracks for several miles in either direction when there's a train coming by. I don't understand all the language in the bill. I'm here to testify to tell you the need for this bridge and the public safety and the economic development that will happen with this.
To the language.
The language we adopted in transportation, which was held over for a week and was discussed, and the language adopted was what the language was suggested by staff and by Representative Hortman's project and by the contractors. And so if there's a need to clarify low versus best value, I'm happy to work with people along the way.
Representative Todd. Mr. Chairman, was best value specifically rejected in favor of low bid, or was it just not discussed?
I don't know if it came up. I'm happy to talk to you about it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, this just highlights my concern about the bill as written, is because the low bid design build process is not used anymore, and through the development of my bill last year, on which I reached agreement with the department, and they're working with ADC to work out those issues, we eliminated the use of low bid design build in for state projects because it's not used anymore, because the best value language meets that need. It just reiterates my concern about the bill as put before us and the tool. I think that the project can be completed. They're in early design or early in pre-design, and I think that the project will actually be slowed down rather than sped up, which is the whole point of design.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. The question before us apparently is the low bid versus best value. So,
Mr. Chair, my name is Ryan O'Connor from the Association of Minnesota Counties, and as Representative Abler just mentioned earlier, this is a mirror language of the Hortman bill that's been heard in Transportation Committee as well, which would have provided broader authority, but other than that, it's the exact same bill. And the language was worked at all summer diligently with the Association of Minnesota Counties. The general contractors were there, designers, builders, and MnDOT. And I can say with confidence from having conversations with all those groups and having heard them testify throughout the process of this bill as well as the other bill, that all groups are comfortable with the language as is. There is no doubt that there are still some issues being worked out between MnDOT and ADC in terms of learning in the wake of the 35W project, as Representative Kalin indicated. However, they are comfortable with that we have adopted everything possible to the extent available at this point. And that the few changes left are probably going to be administrative, and that as this training process would allow those changes to be incorporated as they come about. But AGC has been comfortable that we have adopted those changes to make a fair and open process to bring groups in. So, and to speak to Representative Kahn's point briefly on the low bid versus best value process, the reason for both processes is either one can be used in design build, and the contractors felt much more comfortable having both processes available. There are definitely different types of projects that are conducive to either low bid or best value. And so to preclude having a decision-making authority was decided by all stakeholders to be a dangerous thing to do.
Well, Mr. Chairman, would MnDOT say that they would be they would have been happy doing the 35W bridge under this?
Mr. O'Connor, I don't know if you can respond to that, but go ahead.
I can surmise,
well,
Mr. Chair.
That's Mr. Abler, really.
Either
way.
This process is created in an attempt to be as consistent with MnDOT's process as possible. The only spots where we have deviations from MnDOT's process are to allow for better training of our local officials and local contractors who have not yet been through a design-build process. And that was the intent here, was that we recognize there are not enough firms or local engineers with the training to take on the process in the exact way that MnDOT did it. But in every other place, the process is similar to MnDOT. So I think in all those other areas, the answer would be yes.
And Mr. Chair, this is fine. Okay, that's why this is called a pilot. There's two counties of considerable size and capacity. We're not suggesting that some rural Minnesota counties try this that are small with 4,000 people, but these Anoka and Tecumseh are very capable counties, and that's the thought. And you've heard the testimony, and I hope members can support the bill. Representative
Kahn. Chairman, I'd move to delete Subdivision 11.
There is the motion to delete Subdivision 11. Representative Abler.
Just for information, that would be against what a contractor's own recommendation was to have in the bill. And so this is a composite, and so I think the bill's good the way it is, and you can vote as you like.
All right. The motion before us is to delete Subdivision 11. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Bill is before us. Further discussion.
Well, Mr. Chair, just
Representative Kahn.
I think to the point that Representative Kahn is making in her motion is that the reason why low bid is still included in language as a reference is concerns that continued to arise out of the litigation around the 35W bridge. You might remember that it was originally a $234 million project was the bid, but the project actually cost $371 million or $393 million, depending on your final accounting. The project was initially actually valued at $150 to $250 million. There were concerns about information that was shared during the technical review committee and scoring process that has to be confidential because of the process of design build. I think that the assurances and protections against litigation through that confidential process are not yet in this bill and are not yet finally worked out with AGC and MnDOT. I understand the frustration. I've been through this with a local project. I think you guys are on the right track going through the pre-engineering stage, and I think that you will complete the project and send the message to developers that you need with the guarantees of the low bid process that's working. Design build is very, very risky. And I don't normally, it's a great caution that I ask us to let MnDOT and AGC finish working out the details so that we can have a process next year that does actually work and can protect all those parties involved.
Mr. Kim.
Representative Kim.
Just a question. Was the original 35W bridge built under a low bid process?
Representative Kim, I don't know if we have. Why don't you come back up? And Mr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I refer to the bridge back in the early 60s when it was originally
yes.
built. Yeah, it would have been built under a design bid build process because that was the only one in time in statute in the state at that time, correct?
And a low bid process.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Further discussion to the bill. Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that Senate File 740 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Representative Poppy.
I move the minutes of Thursday, April 2nd.
Representative Poppy moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Members, just before you leave, everyone, we will have a project over the interim and going into the next legislative session as we did last year. It will deal with redistricting. So we will open it up to other members of the House, but we will be focusing on the various elements of redistricting. So just so you know. And with that, meeting is adjourned.